A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You're driving Route 1. Latrune, late afternoon, sun's in your eyes. A car swerves into your lane, no signal, no warning, and you slam the brakes so hard your teeth click. Your heart's pounding. Your hands are shaking on the wheel. You didn't crash. But for the next 10 minutes, you're gripping that steering wheel like it's trying to escape, and every car that comes within 50 meters feels like a threat. That's your amygdala encoding a near miss in real time. It just wrote that moment to permanent storage, flagged it urgent, and turned up your threat detection dial.
That same mechanism, amplified, repeated, never given the chance to dial back down, is the biological substrate of PTSD. In Israel, where conscription is universal, this isn't an abstract neuroscience question. It's a statistical reality playing out across an entire population.
Daniel sent us this one. He's thinking about driving fear as a clean intro to PTSD. What happens in the brain? Why near misses get encoded so vividly? And then the bigger question, what do the numbers actually look like in a conscription society? What percentage of Israelis have PTSD? Does it track with combat exposure, or is something else going on? He wants to know whether professional soldiers develop different rates than conscripts, whether resilience is real or just selection bias, and what treatment actually looks like. The drugs, the therapy, and how you spot trauma in someone who isn't talking about it.
That's a lot of ground. But it all starts in the same place, a structure the size of an almond, sitting deep in the temporal lobe, deciding what's dangerous and what isn't, and sometimes getting that call catastrophically wrong.
The driving thing. That's our way in, because nearly everyone's felt it. Your amygdala doesn't need a war zone, it just needs a prediction error. You expected a routine commute, got a near collision, and the gap between expectation and reality is what stamps the memory. That's the micro model for everything we're about to unpack.
Right, and that's why I think this episode needs 3 layers. Layer 1 is the mechanism itself. What the amygdala actually does when it encodes threat, why those memories feel different from ordinary ones, and what hyperarousal means at the circuit level. Layer 2 is the data. What Israeli prevalence numbers actually show, and specifically what happens when you compare conscripts to professionals to reservists. Layer 3 is treatment and recognition, what works and how you spot it in someone who isn't naming it.
The thing Daniel's really driving at, I think, is the puzzle at the center of Layer 2. Israel has near universal conscription. Most Jewish Israelis serve, most Druze men serve, a growing number of Bedouins serve. That means near universal exposure to military contexts. But most of that service is uneventful. Checkpoints, guard duty, logistics, intelligence. So if PTSD is driven by life or death emergencies, the rates should be low. But the rates are low. So what's actually predicting it?
That's the core tension. Is it trauma dose, the sheer quantity and severity of exposure? Or is it something about the person? Prior vulnerability, the meaning they attached to what happened, whether they volunteered or were conscripted. Israel gives us a natural experiment you can't run anywhere else. You've got a whole population cycled through the same institution, with wildly varying experiences inside it, and detailed epidemiological data coming out the other side. It's one of the most informative case studies in trauma research.
The driving metaphor keeps the whole thing grounded. When we talk about amygdala potentiation or fear generalization, you can always come back to that moment on Route 1. The hands shaking, the 10 minutes of hypervigilance after nothing actually happened. That's the same biology, just at a different dose and duration.
Which is also why the treatment conversation matters so much. If PTSD is a learning process gone maladaptive, not a character flaw, not a broken brain, then the question is, what actually helps unlearn it? Let's get into the hardware. The amygdala isn't one thing. It's a cluster of nuclei, and two of them do the heavy lifting for threat. The basolateral amygdala is the evaluator. It takes in sensory information, what you see, hear, smell, and cross-references it against past experience to decide, is this dangerous? If the answer is yes, it signals the central amygdala, which is the trigger. That's what kicks off the fight-flight-freeze cascade. Heart rate spikes, pupils dilate, cortisol floods the system.
The basolateral complex is the analyst, and the central nucleus is the button it pushes.
But here's where it gets interesting for memory. When the basolateral amygdala flags something as high threat, it doesn't just trigger a physical response. It also talks to the hippocampus, which is the brain's memory indexing system. Normally, the hippocampus files experiences with a kind of neutral timestamp. This happened, then that happened. But when the amygdala is screaming, "This matters," the hippocampus encodes the memory differently. More sensory detail. The emotional charge gets baked into the memory itself.
Which is why you can remember exactly where you were standing and what the light looked like when a car almost hit you. But you can't remember what you had for breakfast last Tuesday.
The flashbulb effect. And the mechanism underneath it is a prediction error signal. Your brain is constantly generating expectations. This drive will be like every other drive. Nothing will happen. When reality violates that expectation, the mismatch itself triggers a surge of norepinephrine in the amygdala. The bigger the gap between predicted and actual, the stronger the encoding.
This is the part that I think people don't intuit. It's not the objective danger level that determines how hard the memory gets stamped. It's the surprise.
100 uneventful commutes produce weak, generic memory traces. One near miss produces a memory so detailed and durable it can intrude for years. And that's the micromodel for combat trauma, too. You can spend months on routine patrol. Nothing happens, nothing happens, nothing happens. And then one ambush rewires the whole system.
Because the prediction wasn't just, this drive will be safe. It was, this patrol will be boring. And the gap between boring and ambush is a chasm.
Once that circuit gets potentiated, once the amygdala has learned that the world can suddenly turn lethal, the sensitivity dial gets turned way up. The technical term is hyperarousal. The threshold for what triggers a threat response drops dramatically. A car backfiring is no longer a car backfiring. It's a grenade. A horn isn't a horn. It's an ambush starting.
The brain stops asking, "Is this dangerous?" and starts asking, "How dangerous is this?" And the default answer becomes, "Very."
That's not a metaphor. Neuroimaging studies show that in PTSD, the basolateral amygdala becomes hyperreactive to ambiguous stimuli, faces that could be neutral or threatening, sounds that could be benign or hostile. The evaluator is biased toward threat, and the central nucleus is firing on a hair trigger. Meanwhile, the prefrontal cortex, which normally provides top-down regulation, the "actually that was just a door-slamming" signal, shows reduced activity. The brakes are offline.
The alarm is louder and the off switch is broken.
That's the circuit-level description. Now let's put it in an Israeli frame. The Times of Israel reported just this month, June 2026, a study finding that 12% of reserve soldiers who served in Gaza combat operations reported PTSD symptoms afterward. That's more than 1 in 10.
The World Israel News piece cited IDF data, putting it at 1 in 8 combat soldiers overall. Those numbers are in the same ballpark, 1 in 8. In a country of about 9.5 million people, with universal conscription, that's not a niche clinical problem. That's tens of thousands of people.
The Al Jazeera piece from late May framed it as a national state of trauma, post-October 7th. Whatever you think of the source, the epidemiological picture they're describing is real. But here's the nuance that most coverage misses, and it comes from that 2020 PMC study. Prevalence isn't uniform across roles. Combat medics and infantry soldiers have significantly higher rates than personnel in logistics or intelligence. We're not just talking combat versus non-combat. We're talking about something more specific.
Proximity to human suffering.
That's exactly what the data suggests. A combat medic treating wounded civilians or wounded comrades is exposed to something that a drone operator or a signals intelligence analyst typically isn't. It's not just danger to self. It's witnessing the damage violence does to bodies, especially bodies that weren't supposed to be in the line of fire.
Which means a checkpoint soldier who never fires a weapon but spends 18 months watching families get separated, watching people be humiliated, watching a child be denied medical passage. That person is absorbing trauma even if nobody ever shot at them.
Their amygdala is encoding every one of those moments. Not as a single dramatic near miss, but as a slow accumulation of prediction errors. the expectation that you'd be a soldier who protects people versus the reality of being a soldier who controls people. That gap is its own kind of trauma.
We've got a mechanism, prediction error plus amygdala potentiation, and we've got numbers that don't map neatly onto who got shot at. That brings us to the question Daniel's really pushing. What does conscription itself do? If everyone serves, but not everyone sees combat, is military service the risk factor, or is it something narrower?
The data says narrower. Mandatory service in Israel, 32 months for men, 24 for women, puts a huge swath of the population in uniform, but most draftees are in non-combat roles. Intelligence, cyber, logistics, education corps, administrative. And their PTSD rates look nothing like infantry or combat medics. The PMC study makes that clear. Prevalence clusters in specific units and specific roles. Conscription per se isn't the driver.
Which challenges the broad assumption that military service causes PTSD. It's not military service. It's what you do in it and what you witness.
That's where the resilience question gets interesting. Daniel asked whether professional soldiers, career officers, special forces, develop lower rates than conscripts. The research suggests they do, but not because they're tougher.
This is the part where people want to believe in the stoic warrior archetype, and the data says something more boring.
Two things are going on. First, selection effects. People who volunteer for combat units, especially elite ones, self-select for psychological robustness before they ever put on a uniform. The assessment pipelines for units like Shayatet 13 or Sayeret Matkal filter for stress tolerance, emotional regulation, the ability to function under ambiguity. You're not sampling from the general population anymore.
By the time someone becomes a naval commando, they've already been screened for the traits that make PTSD less likely.
And then there's training effects. Special forces don't just do more training, they do different training. Repeated exposure to high-stress scenarios with safety protocols built in. They practice ambushes, practice medical emergencies, practice things going wrong over and over until the brain builds what psychologists call mastery experiences. The prediction isn't nothing bad will happen. It's bad things will happen and I know what to do. That's a fundamentally different amygdala calibration.
Which means the conscript infantry soldier who drills for 6 months and then deploys is in a different psychological position than the career operator who's been running stress inoculation training for years. Same army, same uniform, completely different preparedness.
That connects to something more counterintuitive, the moral injury dimension. The PMC study and a lot of recent Israeli reporting point to something that doesn't fit the standard fear conditioning model at all. Some of the most severe trauma reactions come from events where the person wasn't in physical danger.
The checkpoint example. You're 19, you're manning a crossing in the West Bank, and a family comes through with a sick child. Your orders say they can't pass. You enforce the order. The child doesn't get medical care. Nobody shot at you. Nobody exploded anything. But you watched yourself become the person who denied a child passage.
That's moral injury. It's not fear-based. It's about violating your own ethical framework. The person you thought you were, the values you thought you were serving. The amygdala still encodes it because the prediction error is enormous. You expected to be a protector. The reality made you something else. That gap can be more damaging than a firefight.
Moral injury is harder to treat with standard fear extinction protocols because it's not a fear memory. It's a shame memory. It's a guilt memory. Different circuitry, different therapeutic target.
Which brings us to treatment. What actually works? First-line psychotherapy is trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, TF-CBT, or EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Both are designed to help the brain reprocess the traumatic memory so it stops intruding into the present. SSRIs, sertraline, and paroxetine are the two with FDA approval for PTSD. But here's the thing people get wrong. They're not a cure. They reduce the volume of hyperarousal enough for therapy to work. If your amygdala is screaming at a 10, you can't do the cognitive work of reprocessing. Medication dials it down to a 6 or a 7 so you can actually engage.
It's not either or. The evidence is clear that combination treatment, medication plus trauma-focused therapy, outperforms either alone.
In Israel, this isn't theoretical. The Jerusalem Post reported recently that the government has expanded free mental health services for reservist post, October 7th. More clinics, more therapists, more funding. But access is still uneven, especially for reservists who've cycled back into civilian jobs and can't take 3 afternoons a week for therapy.
Which means a lot of people are walking around with trauma circuits that haven't been deactivated. And that brings us to the last thing Daniel asked. How do you spot it? What does PTSD look like in someone who isn't naming it?
Hypervigilance. They scan exits in restaurants, they sit with their back to the wall, they jump at sudden noises that nobody else reacts to. Startle response that's disproportionate. Emotional numbing. Flat effect in social situations. Difficulty expressing warmth. A kind of distance that reads as coldness, but is actually protector shutdown. And avoidance. They won't drive through certain neighborhoods, won't attend events with crowds, won't watch the news. You notice the patterns before you ever hear the words, "I have PTSD."
None of those require the person to have been in a firefight. The checkpoint soldier, the combat medic, the intelligence analyst who watched drone footage of things they can't unsee. The signs are the same. The amygdala doesn't care whether the threat was to you or to someone you were watching. It just encoded it.
Which is why the moral injury finding is so important. If you're looking for trauma only in people who were shot at, you're missing a huge chunk of the people who are suffering.
If someone's listening and they served, or they've got a brother or a spouse or a kid who did, what's the one thing they should take from all of this? It's that PTSD is not a weakness. It's not a moral failing. It's not a broken personality. It's a learning process that evolution gave us for very good reasons. It just got stuck in overdrive. The amygdala is doing exactly what it was designed to do. It learned that the world can turn lethal without warning, and it's refusing to let you forget it.
That reframe matters clinically. If you think PTSD is a character flaw, you hide it. If you understand its biology, potentiated circuits, a hair trigger central nucleus, prefrontal regulation that's gone offline, then it becomes something you can address. You wouldn't be ashamed of a broken arm. This is a broken threat calibration system.
For recognizing it in someone who isn't naming it, Daniel's in the wild. Question. I think the most useful framework is the 3 A's, avoidance, arousal, alteration.
Those aren't pop psychology. They're straight from the DSM-5 symptom clusters. Avoidance. They won't drive through certain parts of town. They change the subject when certain topics come up. They stop watching the news. They skip social events that involve crowds. Arousal. Irritability that seems disproportionate, insomnia, that scanning the exits thing we mentioned, flinching at noises nobody else noticed, alteration, changes in mood or belief systems, the world feels permanently unsafe, they can't experience joy the way they used to, they've gone flat or cynical or both.
The key is that you're looking for patterns, not single incidents. Everyone's irritable sometimes, everyone avoids a conversation now and then. But when all 3 clusters show up together and persist for more than a month, that's not a bad week. That's a trauma reaction.
On the treatment side, the evidence is unambiguous. Combination therapy, medication plus trauma. Focused psychotherapy outperforms either one alone. The SSRI dials down the hyperarousal enough for the person to actually do the cognitive work. You can't reprocess a traumatic memory when your amygdala is screaming at a 10. You get it down to a 6. Then EMDR or trauma-focused CBT helps the brain file the memory properly, as something that happened, not something that's still happening.
Israel's Post. October 7th expansion of mental health services is genuinely significant. More clinics, more funding, free access for reservists. But the Jerusalem Post piece was honest about the gap. Reservists who've cycled back to civilian jobs often can't access consistent treatment. You can't do weekly therapy sessions when you're back at a tech job in Herzliya and your therapist is in Beersheba.
Which means a lot of people are navigating this with incomplete support. And that makes recognition by family and friends, knowing what the 3 A's look like, even more important. You might be the one who notices before they do.
That brings us back to where we started. The wheel, the highway, the hands shaking after nothing actually happened. The same amygdala that made you flinch at a near miss this morning is the same system that, under sustained threat, can rewire an entire life. Understanding that continuity, that it's the same biology, just at a different dose and duration, is the first real step toward destigmatizing this thing.
Because once you see it as a learning process rather than a personal failure, the whole conversation shifts. You stop asking what's wrong with that person and start asking what did their amygdala learn and why hasn't it unlearned it yet?
Here's the open question I keep coming back to. The 12% figure, that's from the current data. The Gaza combat rotations that have already happened. But this war isn't over. A new generation of conscripts is cycling through right now, and the exposure isn't getting lighter. Does that number rise? And if it does, what does a society do when a significant fraction of its population is walking around with trauma circuits that never got deactivated?
That's the question nobody has a clean answer to. Not because the treatments don't exist, they do, but because the infrastructure to deliver them at population scale is still being built. And the people who need them most are often the least likely to ask.
We end where we started, but with the stakes made clear. PTSD is not a disorder of memory. It's a disorder of the present. The boss keeps intruding, and the amygdala keeps treating old threats as current ones. But the science gives us tools to turn down the volume. Not perfectly, not instantly, but...
Now Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1914, a naturalist in the Aleutian Islands documented a distinct dialect of honeybee waggle dance used by a subspecies that vanished shortly after, meaning a unique bee language went extinct before anyone thought to study it further.
A lost dialect of bee dance. Sure, why not?
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to Daniel for the question. If you want to send us your own, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.